Okay. So we are sort of wrapping up Abraham today. Either today or today and next time. I think next time is the last class of this semester. So maybe we will do it this and then start in January with Isaac. But I want to introduce the final chapter of Abraham by pointing out a difference in the way that it is read by modern scholars and by traditional scholars. And that's going to be part of the theme of today. All right, so go to chapter 25, the book of Genesis, chapter 25. Verse 1. All right. Now, Abraham at this point has accomplished everything in his life that he needs to accomplish, right? He has a child who is safely married. By the way, a very nice point. If you look at the last verse of chapter 24, it says, Isaac loved her and found comfort after his mother's death. Right? That's the second mention of love in the Bible. The first mention of love is, if anybody gets this, very impressive. It doesn't say Adam and Eve loved each other. They may have, but it doesn't say so. It says in the Akedah, your son whom you love. So the first mention of love in the Bible is between a parent and a child, and the second mention of love is between a husband and a wife, which is really very beautiful. So it's so Isaac loves Rebekah and found comfort as a result after his mother's death, which is almost a way of combining both, right? Because he clearly loved his mother, which is why he needed the comfort, so he finds it in his wife. Okay, then it says, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. Now, as you will know, if you look at any commentary, many commentators assume that Keturah is Hagar. Okay? Which makes sense from one point of view and doesn't exactly from another point of view. It makes sense from, and by the way, in Jewish tradition, there are commentators who believe it is Hagar and commentators who reject the idea that it's Hagar. It makes sense from one point of view because we already know that he had children with Hagar. And so the commentators assume when Sarah dies and Abraham finds someone, who's he going to find is someone he already had a child with, and since we don't hear any more about Hagar, they assume that that's Hagar. Okay, but you'll notice that when it says he had a wife whose name was Keturah, all of a sudden he has a bunch of kids. And what's that about? Because he had so much trouble having children before, and now all of a sudden he's got all these children. And all of them, by the way, some tribes we can identify and some not. But for example, Midian, right? Midian, does that ring a bell, the name Midian?
Jethro.
Right? What's that?
Jethro.
I can't hear you.
Jethro.
Jethro, right, is from Midian. Because why is Jethro from Midian? Because that's where Moses runs away to, right? That's where he finds his wife and therefore his father-in-law, Jethro, who's a priest of Midian. Because when Moses runs away from Egypt, because he's afraid he's going to be killed, he runs to Midian. Now, why does he run to Midian as opposed to somewhere else? Presumably, Midian was in some way friendly to Jews, right? Jews could run away to Midian. Maybe this hints at a relationship between Jews and Midian, even though later on, they didn't get along so well, right? Later on, with Pinchas, there are conflicts with Midian. But names in the Bible are never just names, right? They always have to represent something bigger than themselves, or why bother to put them in there? And all these names may let us know people with whom Israel in the ancient world had relationships, even though some of them we still remember and some of them are lost, right? Because you have to always assume that for everything we're told, just like in your life, if someone says, how was your day? And you say, oh, I had a terrible day. I spent hours in the mall and didn't find the shirt I was looking for. That means that of everything that happened in the 12 hours of your day, you mention one thing. So the same thing here, in an entire lifetime of Abraham and an entire lifetime of the Israel in ancient lands, we only get a tiny fraction. So they could have had relations with all these different people. We just don't know about most of them. But here is another way to look at this. The traditional commentators, there's a problem with Abraham having all these kids. The problem is, what does he say when God tells him he's going to have a child with Isaac?
I'm so old.
I'm too old. Who can have a kid? And now here we are, 35 years later, and he all of a sudden discovers that not only can he have one child, but he can have how many? I don't even know how many are listed, right? He can have 10 of them, right? Now that's a problem. So if you look in the traditional commentary, it's like I think Emek HaDavar says, once God reinvigorated him so that he could have a child at 100, basically God didn't take the spell off, you know? And so he discovered he could have more kids, which is a traditional, I want to almost say magical sort of view, right? God gave him a special power. Once you got the special power, it stays until God says, I'm taking the special power away. But here's a difference of how a modern scholar looks at it, which, by the way, this is not inconsistent with how a traditional scholar could look at it, but let me read you what Sarna says, which I think is fascinating. Over 40 years earlier, Abraham judged himself too old to sire children. It is hardly likely that he had six sons after the age of 140. Hence, the present report does not relate to a time subsequent to Sarah's death and Isaac's marriage, but to many years before. In other words, this isn't chronological, and we know that sometimes the Torah goes out of chronology. That's why verse 6, like Chronicles 1:32, refers to Keturah as a concubine, not a wife, because look at verse 6. But to Abraham's sons by concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living. Now, concubines, plural, which is why some people say Keturah was one concubine and Hagar was another. But it could be that this is in fact what Abraham did, but he did it while Sarah was alive. Now maybe delicacy prevents the Torah from writing it while he was alive, but fidelity, that is wanting to tell about Abraham's life, leads him to still put it in, but they don't put it in while Sarah's around. I don't know. But it does make sense to think that this is a report of what Abraham did earlier. It tracks better than assuming that all of a sudden, after Sarah dies, he goes out at age 140 and says, you know, now that Sarah dies, I really, you know, now I'm going to go out on the town. Well, yeah, exactly. I'm going to be fruitful and multiply.
Yes, ma'am. Back then, to have
yes. No, not only was it the norm back then, it was the norm in many Oriental countries, it was the norm until our own day, right? In Christian lands, it stopped being the norm much earlier, which is why in Ashkenazi lands, there is a takana of Rabbeinu Gershom, which means, I didn't just start to talk gibberish, that means a takana is a legal decree, and Rabbeinu Gershom was one of the great legal authorities from Ashkenaz, literally Germany. In fact, if you go to Germany today in the old cemetery, you can still see his grave, even though he died in the 11th century. He issued a takana, that is a binding 1,000-year obligation that that men can't have more than one wife. By the way, you know, a takana is literally, they say it lasts for 1,000 years, which is supposed to mean forever. But the official language is 1,000 years, and it has actually expired. I'm sure that some rabbi has renewed it, but I just want you to know that he lived over 1,000 years ago. But that was in Christian lands. But in Muslim lands, as you know, in Yemen, for example, some Jews who moved to Israel in 1948 had multiple wives. And the state of Israel had to decide what to do about it, and what they did essentially was to say, you can't do that once you come here. If you come here with more than one wife, you know, we're not going to say you have to divorce all but one wife, but once you're here, you can't marry multiple wives. So, yeah, it was not at all uncommon, and that's why he assumes that Abraham married more than one wife. Yeah.
Even if this is taking place out of chronology, does that resolve a contradiction between the words Abraham took another wife and to Abraham's sons by concubines.
Well, it does if it's out of chronology and this refers to Keturah as one and Hagar as the other. Then it resolves it. Because this is reporting all the sons he had by Keturah, but we remember that he also had one by Hagar, so, I mean, possible. And, okay, so, but let's now that we've sort of, and the reason, oh, one second, let me double back on myself. The reason I bring this up is I want to say something about this book, for those of you who are interested, because it captures a theme that we repeat again and again, and we just did. James Kugel, who I think actually just left Harvard for a position in Israel, but was a star professor of Hebrew at Harvard for many years and is an Orthodox Jew, but is also a scholar of the Bible, of modern scholarship, he's written many books. He just wrote a book called How to Read the Bible, A Guide to Scripture Then and Now. And what this book does, which is, I mean, it was just waiting for someone to do this, and he was the perfect person to do it, is he goes through many of the stories of the Bible, and he tells you what traditional commentators said and how modern scholarship looks at it. So you can look at one and the other and where they disagree and why they disagree. And so, for example, we'll talk about this more. Traditional commentators see Abraham's life as a series of 10 trials, right? All of them tied together in some way. Modern scholarship sees Abraham's life as a series of discrete stories that don't necessarily tie one to the other, but they came down as traditions and then were put together. And he tells you why that is and how that is and why traditional commentators and modern commentators disagree. So it's a very interesting book, and he is a very interesting guy. Yes. The name is How to Read the Bible, and his last name is Kugel, K-U-G-E-L.
Does he talk about the significance of
Yes, both, both. He has a long preface to it and an afterword and also a long article on his website that discusses it. So, yes?
Follow up on your answer really quick. I'm sorry, I'm still a little confused because if the implication of that then is that Hagar was a concubine and Keturah was the wife?
No, not Keturah was the wife. Keturah is a concubine too. They're both concubines.
Took another wife whose name was...
Yeah, but they're assuming that it's a concubine, not a wife.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. That's what at least Sarna assumes by the comment after. Yeah.
I have a question.
Isha doesn't have to mean wife. It can just mean it took a woman. Yeah.
What makes it a concubine and what makes it a wife? I understand when you couldn't have a...
Among other things, a wife inherits your children. Wife's child inherits the majority of your estate, and she inherits it too if you die, but a concubine doesn't. A concubine doesn't have the same legal status.
But then... They didn't have a marriage, but they could have all these children.
Well, what kind of ceremony they had, we don't know. But yes, you could have all these children with somebody who was in your home and worked for you and served just like a harem, right? And served as somebody that you took care of and who worked for you but didn't have the legal status of your wife.
Yeah, but in order for her to be his concubine, there must be a wife, because if there is not a wife, there's...
So why? Why does there have to be a wife?
So then
you just don't marry that person. You don't give her legal status, but she serves as, you know, as your concubine. Right. Well, if this was during the time of Sarah, then there's not a problem. But you're saying if it's after Sarah, you can have a concubine, I think, without... let me put it this way. You can have relations with somebody, it seems like, in the Bible, and that doesn't count for automatically making them a wife. That's, I think, the easiest way to put it. We can see it with Amnon and Tamar later on when he rapes her, and then, having been raped, she wants him to marry her. Because obviously, just the fact that he raped her is not sufficient to, I mean, obviously, it wouldn't be, but even the fact that he's had intercourse with her isn't sufficient to make them husband and wife. Yeah. Yeah, what wife is Isha, and there are two, Pilegesh is the usual word for concubine. There's another word that escapes me for the moment, but the one they use here also is Pilegesh, Pilagshim. Right. I know, we were just talking about that, but Isha doesn't necessarily, Isha is also a woman. So it could be a wife, it could be a concubine. They translate it as wife, who knows?
What?
No, like there's no Hebrew word that's only husband, really. I mean, Ish is also man.
Right.
So, yeah.
So it's all about economics.
Well, that's a big jump that it's all about economics. I mean, especially when we just saw that Isaac and Rebecca loved each other. I would say that the reason why men had multiple wives and wives didn't have multiple men is largely economic. I mean, economic in the broadest sense. That is, it's social, cultural, economic. But in a world where women couldn't make lives for themselves, the safest thing to do was associate yourself with a man, even if it wasn't ideal, right? But it's better to be with a man who has three wives but will take care of you than to be alone in a marketplace that gives you no way of making a life.
But
so
the difference between a wife and a concubine, why one would persist to become a wife rather than a concubine is to have the
Inheritance, and for your children to have the major inheritance. Yes, that's true.
If Keturah was a concubine during Sarah, would that diminish the position of Hagar? So she would be.
She was one of more than.
Exactly.
She was one of a couple of concubines. I suppose, I don't know. I guess both economically and psychologically, right? Economically, because you're sharing with your kids are going to share with other kids. And psychologically, because, you know, to be the only concubine is different from being part of a harem. However, I just want to say that it is still strange that with all the drama of Hagar, if Keturah is really around, why doesn't she get mentioned? Did she have no part to play in everything that went on? Yeah.
I think that is actually Hagar's relationship to
Sarah. Right. That Hagar, well, that may well be. Maybe Keturah was just Abraham's and Hagar's was Sarah's, and that's why. Because remember that Sarah, right, gives Hagar to Abraham. She couldn't give Keturah to Abraham if Keturah already belongs to him. I don't know. The other possibility is to read this literally, right? The other possibility is that, but then it's hard. If Keturah is really his wife, then how come it says children by concubines? Unless it's, because if you look at verse 5, okay? He has all these kids by Keturah. Then it says, he willed all that he owned to Isaac, but to Abraham's sons by concubines he gives, you know, this and that. So that seems to make it more or less definitive that Keturah is a concubine and not a wife. Yeah.
Also, because we're not sure of chronology.
Right.
It's so hard to, you know, do Keturah against Hagar.
That's true, right. So I don't, the answer is we don't know for sure, yeah.
Couldn't it also be that while Sarah was living, she was there, and then he took Keturah for his wife, and then he had other concubines?
Yes, it could absolutely be. It could also be. It could be that, they're right, that, although, yeah, although why doesn't it say, Keturah bore him all these children, why doesn't it say he gave her, why does it say, didn't he give her them something? He only gave Isaac something and the kids from the concubines and the kids from his second wife, he didn't give anything. It's a tough go. All right. So the short answer is you can't have a concubine. It causes nothing but trouble, not only for you, but of course for all subsequent commentators. This is what, I've quoted this before, this is what Joseph Telushkin says about men in the Bible. He says, it's true that some men in the Bible marry more than one woman, but it never turns out well. So, and it's true, if you look at every time there are multiple women involved with one, I mean, David, Jacob with Leah and Rachel, Abraham with Hagar, and it never turns out well, right? So the Bible's clearly sending a message. And in fact, by the way, as long as we're on the subject, in the Talmud, which is some of it is before Christianity, the development of Christianity, I actually can't think of any rabbi and don't know if there is any rabbi who has more than one wife. So already by the time of the Talmud, which is, you know, what, roughly 1,000 years after David and Solomon, that practice must have died out in the Jewish tradition. But not in not among Jews in Arab lands, where multiple wives were still common or permitted. I don't know the details, which lands more, which lands less. So, okay. Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him all these various children. And I have from Sarna the attempt to identify, I won't go through it all, but the attempt to identify where these different names appear later in the Bible, or so I'll give you an example, okay? Shua, which is the last name in verse 2, is found in cuneiform texts as early as the 18th century BCE. That's before Abraham was supposed to have flourished. It lay on the right bank of the middle Euphrates below the mouth of the river Habor. This very important international trade center may have been the place of origin of Job's friend Bildad the Shuhite. So, the name of Abraham's, one of Abraham's children, is identified with the name of an ancient city. That doesn't actually tell you that much, because you could name someone after a city. You could have a name that is similar to the name of a city, right? If you name a kid Phil, it might sound, then in later years they identify Philadelphia and they say, aha, right? The source of the name Philadelphia. Or it could be that, as some modern scholars assume, that in fact Abraham's, the name of Abraham's children is symbolic of different civilizations around there. And what you're getting are not children, but tribes, basically, right? To let you know about the geography and the relationship of the time. Because some modern scholars assume that when you give a list of names of children, what you're really doing is giving a list of the tribes or the areas with which Israel had trading partnerships, contracts, and you're not talking about individuals, you're talking about cities or civilizations, right? So, for example, thousands of years from now, you would have an epic that would say, and America had many children, and they were Mexico, Canada, England, Ireland, on and on, in which you're really writing a story about international relations, but it's written in the way, it's written as though it were a story about an individual and his or her children. Okay? So you can read it any one of those many, many different ways, or all of those ways, actually. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. They're not necessarily that you can only read one and not the other. All right. Then we have the descendants of Midian. Abraham willed all that he owned to Isaac, and I have three reasons how it is that that it says the list raises questions about how Isaac ends up being the only descendant that matters. And there are three measures that Abraham takes to make sure Isaac is the only one that matters. The first is he's the sole heir to all of Abraham's stuff after he dies. The second is that Abraham already makes gifts to his other children while he's alive, which is a way of ensuring that they don't have a claim against the estate afterwards, right? Because if he had wanted to give them something else, he would have, since he gave them gifts while they're alive. And third, notice that they migrate to other areas, which is another way of saying, here, you have your gifts, now go away, because Isaac is going to be the one who gets this territory, right? So by all three means, Abraham ensures that Isaac is going to be the one who inherits him. And in fact, after this very brief mention of all these children, they basically disappear, right? I mean, they may come back in other ways, but as tribes, but not as people.
Is it something about Isaac? Does it say something about Isaac?
I don't.
Does it say something about?
Well, there's a lot about inheritance and inheritance law, but I assume what it's about is the degree to which the wishes of the patriarch were absolute in that time, and if he took care of it while he was alive, it was taken care of. So I would say actually that the lesson here is clear. Right? That a lot of people, I mean, we all know situations like this, leave messes for their children after they die. And I cannot emphasize enough to those of you who have parents who have estates to tell them that if they don't divide it up very clearly and make everyone know exactly what they're getting and make it as ironclad as possible while people are alive, that what they're doing is ensuring that their children will fight each other after they die, right? And if you have not said that to your parents, say that to your parents. What you're doing is ensuring that your children will fight after you die. Because I have seen it so many times, I can't possibly, I mean, fortunately, my family has absolutely no money. So we've never been, my poor parents will never be cursed with this. But for those, my father was a rabbi all his life, and he had four children that he had to put through school, whatever scraps are left, you know. But for those families who have estates, it's a serious, as you know, I mean, I don't have to tell you, it's a serious issue. And maybe the lesson from this is that even though Abraham clearly had started to have a very complicated legacy, he took these steps very clearly to physically distance, to economically lay out the details were, and to take care of it in a way while he was still alive, so that if there were any questions, he could answer them definitively. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm wondering, why didn't he give those away? Aren't those?
It's a nice comment, but the Torah doesn't say that. And I don't want to suggest that that means that he didn't give spiritual gifts to Isaac, right? Although it seems to me that the pshat here, that is the clear meaning, is that he gave them economic gifts. But who knows? Maybe he gave them spiritual gifts too. But I find it hard to believe that he doesn't give them specific. It says matanot, which are just gifts. But anyway, I mean, I like to think that he gave them spiritual gifts too.
How did your rabbis at that time announce them husband and wife?
There was no such thing as a rabbi, right? So I think, you know, as I was saying, there must have been some kind of legal formula or legal declaration, because it's an interesting thing. You know, we don't have in the Bible any information about how people got married. We have information about how people got divorced. Sefer Kritut, right? We're told if a man gives his wife a bill of divorce, that's how we get a get, right? The idea of a get. But we don't know in the Bible how people got married. But I assume that there's some declaration, some formula that later on developed into the ketubah. What exactly the ketubah meant in ancient times, though, can't tell you for sure. But it's clear that there must have been something that distinguished a wife from concubines. I just don't know what it was. Maybe it was, I don't know. You know, it says that Isaac took Rivka into his tent. Maybe the concubine doesn't live in your tent, and maybe the wife does. I don't know. Yeah.
Are the kids that Keturah bore Abraham, are they Jewish or are they Jews?
It's a very interesting question. Are Abraham's children who are not Isaac Jewish? In the Bible, it's more a function of what tribe you belong to than it is whether you're biologically Jewish, right? Because although it's true, for example, that Yishmael is Abraham's child, he's clearly not Jewish.
My mother's not Jewish.
Right? Well, but that's what I'm saying. It's that would be true if it weren't the case that Isaac's kids are Jewish. Is Rivka Jewish? She didn't grow up Jewish. And Jacob's kids are Jewish, right? And Joseph's kids in Egypt, even though he marries an Egyptian, right? All of them are assumed to be Jews. That's how Jacob blesses them. So when it changed to matriarch from patriarch is actually later, even though there are hints of it earlier. That is, Sarah, it seems to be the determinant because that makes... But the fact that someone is Abraham's child only makes them Jewish if they stay with Abraham. Right, Isaac's children are only Jewish if they stay. Jacob stays with him. Esau doesn't. Right? Esau goes off and creates his own world, Edom. and becomes his own tribe. So it was more fluid then than now, but in some ways, to be perfectly honest, just in this room, mm-hmm. it was exactly the same. And the reason I say it was exactly the same is, even though Jewish law will consider your children Jewish, no matter where they go or what they do, realistically speaking, your children and grandchildren will only be Jewish if they stay near the Jewish world. Right? If, in fact, they go off to another world and their kids do and their kids do and their kids do, yeah, it might be that in five generations, one of them will discover they were Jewish and come back. But the vast majority of Jews who have left Judaism stay left, right? They don't come back. So it's almost organic. If your children stay with you and stay around and so on and are connected to the community, then they're Jewish. If they leave, although Jewish law may consider them Jewish, it has no effect on their lives. So, yeah.
Excuse me, I'm still struggling with Keturah as to whether or not she is a Hagar or not. If she is Hagar, then presumably, I think, Ishmael and these guys would be half-brothers.
Yeah.
And there's no connection.
They'd be full brothers, not half-brothers.
Full brothers.
Yeah.
And would they not be part of the huge world that is given to Ishmael?
Maybe. Possibly.
Have them just disappear off. So it, to me, the inference, therefore, would be push gets to shove. It's not going to happen.
Well, that's only assuming that Ishmael and his brothers all have to share the same world. But a lot of brothers take different territories. So maybe they scattered off, as brothers often do, to different parts of the world. And they all had, you know, this one had his business, and that one had his business. And one went into the shmata business, and the other went into the jewelry business. And the third one sold leather goods. I don't know. Yes?
With all this talk about the legality, to me the imagery is, we talked about Abraham having hakol. He had everything in his old days. Well, here, this seems to be tied to it, and he's not a lonely yeah. guy just living off what's going on with Isaac and Rebecca. Here, finally, with all this time, he has a wife and kids running around the house, and he lives with a full life.
Yeah.
And the imagery that he gives, the full life being basically, I can't imagine Keturah not being in the tent.
Not being what?
When you were talking legally, maybe right. would be in the tent, but if oh. he had six kids,
yeah, all right, exactly. So here's what I would say. This is Sarna's comment on old and contented, because in look in verse 8, Abraham breathed his last, right? Zakein v'savea v'yasef elamav, old and contented. And then I want to get to the next phrase. Such a summation of a life is found with no other personality in biblical literature. Abraham is the only one who gets old and contented. Now, in accordance with what you say, it may be because he's the only one who had, you know, six sons after age 140, which, you know, presumably would make you old and contented. But it also, it says, it describes not his longevity, which is otherwise mentioned, but the quality of his earthly existence. So it may be, in fact, that that's what it's trying to tell us, is that Abraham was rewarded and given, you know, everything, even after he lost his wife. And it is a much more beautiful picture, if you think about it, of course, after Sarah's gone, right? It makes Abraham's life less savory, less nice, if all of this was going on while Sarah was still alive, right? Because Sarah's struggle was with barrenness. That's why she gives Hagar. And it's one thing, the whole drama with Hagar is one thing, because Sarah initiates it in some way. But if Abraham, in the meantime, is saying, listen, you work it out with Hagar, I'm going to be next door with Keturah, then it's much less, obviously, you know, that makes the story not so nice.
Well, yeah. It's less romantic, but more practical.
Right, so,
but it's also true. Doesn't have the Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar stories.
Right.
Just have a sense of a smaller,
they
less,
do.
Less wealthy,
expansive family. Well, unless it's clear to everybody that these kids don't count, which is possible. I don't know. Yeah.
Couldn't the chronology be that sometime in between when Isaac was born and the
Akedah?
other woman came to
it him. Could be, right. That's a good point. It doesn't have to be before Isaac. It could be after Isaac, when Sarah no longer is bearing children, and Abraham is, apparently,
yeah.
Right. Exactly.
There's no Viagra then.
That's right. And Sarah's, well, remember, Sarah was already 100 when Isaac was born, or almost. And so, yeah, it's possible. There are a lot of configurations. It gives you a different picture of Abraham, but it's clear that I would say this. There is no, I get no feel from the Bible of condemnation here. Whatever is going on with Abraham, it's not as though the Bible feels like this is a terrible thing that Abraham did. But it was a very, it's a different world. It's a different world.
It was a normal human being.
Well, no, it certainly doesn't say he was a normal human being, right? I mean, because everything Abraham's gone through, we're clearly supposed to see him as an exceptional human being. As a human being, but an exceptional human being. I mean, this is the one that God chose to go to Israel and to create the Jewish people, and who argues with God for Sodom, and who God has take his child up to the mountain. So it doesn't.
Really special, but
yes.
Maybe as a man, he was just an average.
I don't. The word average is
like
reduces him.
Human being.
He is a human being.
Needs.
He is a human being. That there's no doubt about that. But I don't. I don't even think that the story of children is intended to address his sexual needs. It's intended to address his procreative ability, right? And the fact that he has other children, and that's, you know, supposed to show him not in terms of his needs, but in terms of his virility is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Right.
Which really is like a foreshadowing of this, you know, enormous, what we now know to be this great split between Isaac and Ishmael, which is a really interesting sort of, like maybe the only way you can have a full life is if you continue the drama to the next generation, even though you think that you have it.
You know, it's a funny thing, because the truth is, for many, many generations before there was... certainly before there was an Arab people, or before there was a Muslim people, commentators saw this as a wonderful reconciliation, not as a foreshadowing of conflict. I mean, Isaac and Ishmael, clearly they've had their differences, but they come together to bury their father, and it just shows how what a good job, in some ways, Abraham did. Now, today, you might retroject back, you know, but let's say that tomorrow there were peace. If tomorrow there were peace, people would use this again as a verse, right, as a foreshadowing of peace, which is one of the reasons why using the Bible to read today is so tricky, because there almost isn't a way that you can't read it. So when people say it's predicted in the Bible, yes, but if the opposite happened, it would also be predicted in the Bible. Yeah. It's certainly true that it's easier. Isaac doesn't have Sarah to say don't play with him anymore.
And the other thing is, I wonder when the Jews ultimately ended up back in Egypt, did they reconnect with all these relatives? I mean, they had a whole bunch of relatives who were living there at this point.
Yeah, that seems like it was far too many generations down. I mean, it doesn't say anything about it, but who knows? I do want to say something though about the verse in between the two we've just been talking about. Abraham breathed his last dying, good old and contented. He was gathered to his kin, or rather the phrase, gathered to his kin. And here I, again, want to read you Sarna's comment on this, which I think is really interesting. This phrase, peculiar to the Torah, is used of, it's used of the following people, okay? Yeasef El Amav, Yishmael, Isaac, Jacob, Aaron, and Moses. A very interesting collection of people, and not whom you would normally assume, right? An analysis of the context is distinguished from death because the action follows death, right? He died, and then he was gathered to his kin. It's not the same as burial in an ancestral grave, because it's used of Abraham, Aaron, and Moses, none of whom was buried with his forefathers. It's also, remember, Abraham is buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, right? But he's the first generation buried in there. He doesn't get buried with his father, Terach. He gets buried with his children, but not with his fathers. It's also not identical with the interment in general, because report of burial follows this phrase. It would seem, therefore, that this, as well as lying down with your fathers, which is also used often in the Torah, testifies to a belief that despite his mortality and perishability, a human being possesses an immortal element that survives the loss of death. Death is looked on as a transition to an afterlife where you are united with your ancestors. This interpretation contradicts the widespread but apparently mistaken view that this notion is unknown in Israel till later times. Because it does make sense that if some people are gathered to their ancestors, it could be a poetic trope for just they died, but it seems like there is this idea that somehow they go to them. And the same thing that people believe today is as old as Abraham or before, right? That you're gathered to your ancestors. So it's worth noting because he does make the very interesting point that it happens after death. So it can't mean by dying you're gathered. It's something that happens after death. We had a class about the afterlife, but this certainly fits in with everything that we said. Yeah?
Amav means basically nation. So the translation says kinship. So would that be, is that the right translation, kinship, or?
Well, Amav is his nation, but remember that Amav is, there's not a big distinction in early Israel between your tribe, your kin, and your nation. They're all essentially the same. And especially, Abraham doesn't have a nation yet. He just has forefathers, right?
Because you said one of the translations for Keturah and all those children could be all the nations that maybe he...
Right.
Maybe Keturah means crown, so maybe he ruled those nations or...
Keturah actually also comes from spices. So I don't, but it's a big, let me put, it's a nice midrash. I don't know if it's intended for anything other than to suggest that he goes to the people who died before him. Because if you want to do it geopolitically, does that mean that Abraham joined other, you know, the nation of Israel joined other nations? I don't know, possible. Yeah. Before or after him.
He's
gathered to his, right.
To those people who are most closely related to him. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember where it is
that,
right, it could be before, it could be after. There doesn't, exactly. I'm trying to remember where it is. It was in a movie or something recently where someone said to someone else, who are your people? Don't you have people? You got to have people. You know, as in everybody has to have some kind of community. Like, you can't be alone. There has to be somebody that you can call. Somebody who cares about you. Somebody who takes care of you. So it's the same thing here. You know, Abraham has people. He has people on this side of death, and he has people on the other side of death. And who they are, is not specified, but everybody's got people. Yeah. Okay. All right, let's... Okay, his son Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the field of Machpelah, Ephron the Hittite, which is also, remember, who bought that land? Abraham. His negotiations bought the land that he will eventually be buried in, okay? The field that Abraham bought from the Hittites, where Abraham was buried and Sarah his wife. and again, the same word is used, Ishto. After the death of Abraham, God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac settled near Be'er Lachai Roi. And then it sort of finishes off. This is the line of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's slave, bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names in order of their birth. And then it offers all the names. And then it offers the names by their villages and their encampment. And then it comes to Ishmael. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. This is verse 17. Then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his kin. They dwelt from, well, so on. And Now, it says, from the patriarchal period on, the Bible only records the lifespans of the hero of Israel. The notice of Yishmael is exceptional, and it probably is there because of Abraham's age at his birth and the boy's age when he's circumcised, both of which are mentioned. But once it gives Ishmael's age, it doesn't give the age of anyone else who's not part of the lineage of Israel. And this ends the story of everything. In some ways, this is the beginning of the story of the birth of the people Israel, right? Abraham's life is the struggle to create that people. Now Yishmael completely leaves the biblical story, and from now on it's the story of Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and then all of Israel, right? That's the individual biographies, and then with the book of Exodus, the collective biography. Okay, so that's Abraham. Questions, comments about anything in the Abraham story? Yes?
Coming off of what you just said, why do you think we even have verses 12 through 18 if Ishmael, I mean, basically we don't really get anything about Ishmael's life,
right,
his lineage, and then he's gone. So what's the relevance of...
I mean, this is a much discussed and debated issue about why the Bible has genealogies. And I'll give you at least I'll give you a sample of, well, the same question actually arises with other people too, which is why offer genealogies? For example, why is Abraham's brother Nahor, why are his kids mentioned? Rivka is one of them, so we understand why she's mentioned, but what about the others? So part of it is any important character, and he is clearly an important character, has to be situated in terms of where they came from and what happens after them. But the usual answer of moderns is that all these people were probably areas, tribes, cities, and all of them were important in the ancient Near East. So even though we may, and again, Sarna tries to identify the various areas and tribes. So he talks about the villages they live in, where how they're described in chronicles. I'll give you an example. Jetur and Naphish. I'll just read you a tiny bit of what modern scholarship does. Jetur and Naphish, who are described in verse 15, okay? Now, the average reader just looks Jetur, Naphish, doesn't pay any attention to them, but that's not what biblical scholars do. They're both described in Chronicles as being Hagrites. That is most probably descendants of Hagar, right? Hagrites. They're said to have warred with the with the Israelite Transjordanian tribes of Reuven, Gad, and Half-Manasseh. So they do come into history later as antagonists of Israel. A district of Ituria in Lebanon, anti-Lebanon, and Mount Hermon region is mentioned in Roman classical sources as the home of a predatory Arab people, the Iturians. This name is derived from Jetur. So all of these names have some echoes in later history, some of which we know, some of which we don't. You can imagine in a couple thousand years, to use the example that I used before, the city of Philadelphia might not be known to anyone, right? So they might know America, but they wouldn't know Philadelphia. And so the name Phil would not, you have no idea that that has any relationship, or that it has a relationship to the ancient Greek city of Philadelphia, which is where the modern city gets its name. So we're dealing with things thousands of years ago where there are very, very few, if any, written records. But presumably all of these names had a valence at the time. Yeah.
Keturah's children, like Hagar's son, Ishmael, is sent, you know, he sends him away, but God says, you know, don't worry,
right,
we're going to make him a great nation. But Keturah's children, he just sends away, and it's just, they
right,
don't even come back for his burial, and
nope,
just sent away, but he could have kept them, you know.
Well, he didn't keep them. Well, it says why he didn't keep them. Because if you keep them around, they're going to contest Isaac and make trouble for him. And Isaac is his heir. You know, I don't know. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. In the ancient world, what relationship a father had to his concubine's kids. My guess is, you know, even now, there are people who have many, you know, you read modern biographies of a specialty royalty or near royalty, that is in countries where politicians are near royalty, and they have many children, and they have almost no relationship to them whatsoever, don't even know that they're their children, so. But Hagar's son was different, right? Because Sarah brought Hagar to Abraham so that he would have a child because Sarah couldn't give him one, and he would be counted as Sarah's child. And that arrangement only got disturbed once Sarah had Isaac. So from the beginning, Ishmael was in some ways really Abraham's child, whereas the children of the concubines, he had an obligation to give to get them started in life. But whether it's physiological or cultural, the bond between father and child, clearly from ancient times to modern times, is different from the bond between mother and child, right? When, for example, in the inner city, there are any number of children who don't have fathers, right? Single mothers whose fathers ran away, this is not, unfortunately, an uncommon occurrence. But how many kids have no mothers? Right? There isn't a phenomenon of all these fathers who are raising kids alone because mothers ran away. Does it happen? Yeah, it happens. I mean, every human phenomenon happens. But much, much more fathers run away. So the idea in the ancient world that Abraham sends his kids off with a good start in life, it seems as though that's all that's expected of him, because it's not really his child. Isaac is really his child. And for Isaac, you see, he takes infinite pains, right? Which, by the way, I just want to say, what it shows in some measure is that that the best predictor of the connection between the father and the child is the connection between the father and the mother. Because Abraham's clearly connected to Sarah. So Sarah's child feels like his child, but maybe he's not so connected to Keturah, so her children don't feel as much. Yeah. I think the age difference was about 13 years, and when he was sent away, he was young. He was a child. I mean, it seems from the story like he was, you know. When he was sent away the second time, yes. The first time, it seems like he was younger, right? The first time he was younger. Yes. Which in the ancient world is, you know, is an adult. That's why we have a bar mitzvah, right? Which is why bar mitzvah today is much too young. We should have it at 20 instead of, it's true, you know that. Or we should have second bar mitzvahs. Okay, let's take three more questions and then we'll wrap it up. 1, 2, 3.
If, I don't know if the chronology here tracks, but if the episode of Keturah and the sons happens during Sarah's lifetime, then at the Akedah, when God says, take your son whom you love,
right?
Doesn't that maybe put more of a spotlight on Isaac if now you have all of these sons, and you know, as opposed to just it being Ishmael versus Isaac?
Yes.
Now,
yes, it does. It does. If you count all these as more sons, then he's talking about Isaac as opposed to all these other kids. Yeah.
So we know of Abraham as the father of monotheism. Is there any indication of that in the text? We know that he has a relationship with
that's a great question. The question was, we know of Abraham as the father of monotheism. Is there any indication of that in the text? Here is the answer that I will give you, and Kugel actually deals with exactly this question in his discussion of Abraham. He says, if you look for an indication in the Bible, modern scholars, now we're modern scholars, okay? If you look for an indication in the Bible that Abraham believes in only one God, that there are no other gods, you won't find it. What you will find is that Abraham believes in this God, but not that he believes that only this God exists. Nowhere does he say all other gods are nonsense. However, if you look at it with the story of a classical commentator, Abraham gives full allegiance to that God because he believes that's the only God. So if you read the text with those glasses, so to speak, then you see Abraham as a monotheist. But if you read it, if you came from Mars and read the story of Abraham, and at the end you said, Abraham grew up in a world where people believed in lots of gods, does this story tell you that Abraham rejected that belief? I don't think that you'll find it in the Abraham story. So, yeah.
Well, I was just thinking it was interesting that Khalid Husseini, the kiterunner who wrote The Thousand Sons.
I haven't read The Thousand Sons. But.
Okay, The Thousand Sons is precisely about the daughter of the concubine.
Is it?
And the relationships between women and legitimacy,
right,
and illegitimacy in that culture. I thought it was kind of a...
You should... Have you read The Red Tent?
Yes.
Yeah, same, right, same sorts of issues. So the I would say this, that the Bible is fairly ruthless in its focus, not always, but most of the time, in its focus on what's going to advance the story of the nation of Israel. And some of the most interesting characters, not only in the Bible, but in any book, are the characters that are mentioned and are not developed. And they leave room for you to imagine what their lives are. Like, what was Keturah's life? What was, you know, Hagar's life? What happened to all the kids after they left Abraham? And did they ever have contact with him again? What happened when Isaac and Ishmael came back and buried Abraham? What happened with Sarah during the time of the Akedah? And did she ever know about the Akedah? And who told her about the Akedah? And why does she die? Why is her death mentioned right after the Akedah? So all of those stories are very rich areas for elaboration. But the lack of voice that's given to the stories of most of the women in the patriarchal narratives, and you can even hear it in the phrase, right? That's what they're called, the patriarchal narratives, suggests to you not just the way the society was, but also the way the book's written. Right? So it's not only about what happened, it's also about what was written about what happened, as is illustrated by the fact that you can make a novel out of the concubine's life just as easily as you can make a novel out of the king's life. It just depends who you pay attention to. But as a last point, that consciousness is really new in human history. And it's not only a consciousness of the stories of women, although that's a big part of it. It's also, if you go to history departments today, you get stories of it used to be the history was basically about kings and soldiers and powerful men. That was history, that's what you learned. I mean, read the plays of Shakespeare. Right? Although Shakespeare's domestic plays are more give voice to women. But that's what history was. Now you get the histories of the commoners, of slaves, the stories of all those stories that historians were uninterested in up to really about 100 years ago. So there is an examination now of the counter-narratives of the Torah. That is not the dominant story, but the stories underneath the stories, which really does enrich the story. Maybe next time, to finish off Abraham, I'll bring you the five books of Miriam, and we'll take a look at what the woman's commentary says about Sarah and her story and the beginning of Rebecca, and that way we'll finish off the year on a sweet note. All right, thank you.